ignition.
You're listening to EU Watchdog Radio.
Welcome to EU Watchdog Radio. My name is Hans van Scharen, media officer at Corporate Europe Observatory. On Monday, the 25th of May, two NGOs, CEO and Global Health Advocates, published two investigative reports with a bang. It made the headlines all over Europe, which was in a way kind of strange, because these two reports are about the ways the European Union funds scientific research, not exactly the most sexy topic in the world. The reports are about how, in the name of innovation, industry has managed to control the use of 3.6 billion euros in European public research funds. Yep, you've heard that right. So for the past 12 years, industry lobby groups have controlled the use of billions in public EU funds for health and climate research through two so-called public-private partnerships, or PPPs, and this at the expense of the public interest. The two reports show that these lobby groups have prevented these partnerships from meaningfully investing into research projects that address the societal challenges, such as epidemic preparedness, quite telling in times of widespread COVID-19, or to invest in viable climate solutions. The EU research funds were mostly used to fund their own commercially profitable research projects instead. These lobbies are now lobbying for these PPPs to be renewed in a comparable form in the next EU budget, under the so-called EU research programme Horizon Europe, which will run from 21 until 27. And all this with the support of the European Commission's DG Research and Innovation. Now, I will be discussing the content of these two in-depth and damning reports with Martin Pigeon, researcher and campaigner at CEO, and Marine Ejurian, advocacy manager at Global Health Advocates. The first report that we will discuss is called More Private Than Public: The Ways Big Pharma Dominates the Innovative Medicines Initiative. This Innovative Medicines Initiative, or IMI, is the largest and oldest of all PPPs and was originally designed to improve public health by speeding up the development of innovative medicines and making them accessible to patients, especially for health issues or diseases that don't get much attention or funding. And the second report is called Research and Destroy: The Factories of the Industrial Bioeconomy Threaten the Climate and Biodiversity. And this report deals with another PPP called the Bio-Based Industries, BBI. This one was created to support a more resource-efficient and sustainable low-carbon economy, and to increase economical growth and employment, especially in rural areas across the European Union. But, as Martin and Marine will explain during this podcast, that is not exactly what happened. Thank you for being with me this morning. Martin, first of all, could you explain this vast research that is underlying these two reports? Why and how did it all start?
Well, in fact, at CEO, it is a bit of an old story, this, because already back in 2006-07, we were paying attention to things called the European Technology Platforms. And these were public-private partnerships between the European Commission and industry lobby groups to define strategic research agendas. That is a common research program that that the European Commission would draw inspiration from to draft its own research proposal, call to proposals, so its own research policy. And that was an implementation of the so-called Lisbon strategy, which at the time when it was designed was meant to make of the EU the most knowledge-intensive bio-based economy, if you remember. Knowledge-based bioeconomy, sorry. Those were the proper terms. And so this was done. And already back in 2007, I think it was, two of my colleagues, Nina and Belen, had published about the biofuel ones in particular, where they were wondering why this was happening, why the Commission was asking the biofuels industry to push this, whereas we already knew back then that this was a very bad idea with dangerous consequences for you know, deforestation and biodiversity and the climate, actually. This was already known by the time, 13 years ago. And the answer was from the Commission was very clear. It was like, yes, indeed, those are industry driven, but that's what we want. That is the objective. This is the policy. And it happened. And these structured design strategic research agendas, and some of them were so big and so ambitious that the Commission helps probably with industry, realized that they had to upscale the whole thing. And they created something called the Joint Technology Initiatives. And those are the first iteration of what we have studied, of the public-private partnerships that we have studied this time, that are now called the Joint Undertakings. And one of the first Joint Technology Initiatives was indeed the IMI, was the Innovative Medicines Initiative, which started in 2008. You're talking 1 billion euros. For the public contribution to the IMI. So that gives you a scale of what's going on there. You're talking about industry-driven structures that are defining the use of billions of euros of EU public research funding, of taxpayers' money. And so we've been following this for a very long time, basically. And we always suspected that those were, you know, very problematic, but between having this assumption and showing it and researching it, there's a vast difference. And we never managed to master the resources to do it until last year, where we decided that, you know, this was it. And we had to try. And what helped really is meeting up with global health advocates and one of your colleagues, Marine Jill Mercado, who's now with our Friends of the Earth, and who at the time had developed really a unique expertise among the NGO world on the inner workings of the EU's research policy programs. Like she had really spent a lot of time digging into it. And yeah, those were rare skills. And we thought that, you know, this was the opportunity basically to finally do this project.
Yes, because EU research policy is quite a technological, it seems a very, let's say, abstract, technological, non-sexy issue to research into and doesn't get much attention from the wider public. Why were you so convinced that this was important, again, to dig into? And how did you do the research?
Well, first of all, it is true that the EU's research policy and research policy in general is seen by the public, but even the NGOs and most of the media as something complicated, and it is complicated, there's no discussion of that, as something that is primarily for the scientists, that, you know, that it is important because it's research, and who's against research, right? So it's not seen as very problematic. Whereas in our work, you know, studying corporate lobbying, time and again, we see that industry manages to, well, first of all, always claims that science is on its side. You know, this you have this permanent science washing, whereas when you dig, and it takes time and efforts to find it, but when you dig, you realize that these people are not at all using science there. Actually destroying it quite actively by not publishing the findings, by polluting the academic literature, you know, by attacking very vigorously any independent researcher who dares to publish results that would, you know, threaten their commercial interest. I mean, there is, you know, there is a lot of talk at the moment that, you know, science is getting a bad name in the public, and that people don't trust science. You know, I refer you to, you know, the discussions on vaccines and stuff. But I mean, for me, this is a big, big part of the problem. This permanent instrumentalization by industry of the moral prestige of science. And we shouldn't, and sciences and research are two important public goods to leave industry do that with them. It's too important. I mean, that's also why we try to do this work, is that we want to reclaim public science for us, for the public good.
Right, but before I get to the IMI, but that is exactly the argument that the European Commission and others will use to defend these public-private partnerships by saying, well, we are investing public money into scientific research. That's good, no?
Well, you have two parts in that. Scientific research as such is important, but the question is, what are you looking for? You know, you have two moments in research. The first moment is very political. It is, what is the question you're going to try to answer? What is your assumption? That is a political decision, you know? And then you're going to try to answer it. And then this is where the scientific methodology comes in, where fundamentally it is about peer review, being reviewed by your peers, that, you know, your results stand scrutiny, that you haven't, you know, fucked up in your experimental protocol or your methodology, and that in most of the cases, it's not always possible, but whenever possible, someone else using your data and your methodology would reach the same result. It's not very complicated, but it's very rigorous, and it takes a lot of time and efforts to do well.
Marine, on the IMI, because that's what global health advocates focused on in this project. How did it start for you? Why did you want to dig into this beast called IMI?
So Global Health Advocates, as an NGO working on equitable access to health, has been following the EU R&D policies for some years now. But initially, our focus was more into resource mobilization for research and development of medicines that are so-called market failure. So disease areas that are not profitable enough for the industry to invest. So what we were doing at the beginning was to advocate for more resources, more funding from the European Commission to be invested in these disease areas, specifically for the Global South, because some of the diseases that are for which we don't have vaccines and medicines are touching these poorer countries, so-called poverty-related and neglected diseases. But then in the last years, access to medicines has increasingly become also an issue not only for the Global South, but also for the European countries, Western countries, because of the excessive price of some innovative medicines for cancer, for example, or hepatitis C. So there was more attention also on access issues, affordability issues also in Europe. So it became, unfortunately, only after it became an issue in Western countries, there was more attention to these issues. So a couple of years ago, we started a campaign looking into not only resource mobilization, but also the quality of the policies for biomedical R&D. And one striking issue was that despite the high level of public investments for biomedical R&D, we still end up with very high prices for so many medicines. So basically, high prices are justified by the pharmaceutical industry by high cost of research and development. But on the other hand, we don't really have transparency on the costs. While we know that, and there is evidence that there is a big amount of public funding. So basically, we are kind of we end up in a situation when we pay twice for our medicines. We pay first through public subsidies, through universities and research centers, but then we have to pay again in the pharmacies when you get that. So this is not fair. I mean, you know, even if we follow the market logic of ensuring return on the investments, what about return on public investments? So this kind of this approach got some attention from the politicians, from the government. So there were like more and more discussions about the need of ensuring transparency in public funding, the need to ensure that these public investments are reflected in the final price of the medicines. So, our starting point was to make sure that you are in the investments attach conditionalities on the affordability of the final price of the final products. And the Innovative Medicines Initiative is one of the mechanisms for EU R&D policies. And we've been following also the funding, the initiatives through this platform, especially as there have been some criticism around the governance issues, transparency issues. There was a scandal with one project on antimicrobial resistance, for example, when public partners had to withdraw because of conflict of interest issues. There was also a very comprehensive report from Der Spiegel on some of the issues of transparency and the governance and the priority setting, giving some examples of industry dominance in this platform. But from our side, the civil society organizations, we felt that we don't have enough evidence, enough facts for meaningful advocacy work. So that is why, as Martin mentioned, last year we teamed up with the Corporate Europe Observatory, my colleague Jill, led on this comprehensive research project. So she had already spent a lot of time and resources into understanding better how the EU Horizon Europe program works.
That's now the umbrella name is In the Name of Innovation. And what I understand from what you're saying, one of the things you are implying is that basically on the level of transparency, there is really a huge issue, because you couldn't just go to a website and download information. You basically had to dig. You had to, if I understood it well, get access to information. Get back for documents or ask for documents, interview people. I mean, there's a lot of information gathering. Is this correct? Is there a problem in transparency and in how and what does that tell us about other bodies that are basically evaluating the results of these public-private partnerships?
I think one major issue with transparency in terms of understanding how this works was related to the decision making in the partnerships. Because in the case of IMF, for example, we got very important, valuable information through reading through the governing board documents, minutes. This is the main decision making body, where we have representatives from the European Commission and the FPI, Industry Lobby Group. So it's helped us quite substantially to understand the discussions they had in terms of the priorities, agenda setting, what were the proposals, what were the justifications for investing in this area or that area. This was one important source of information that was missing, because they are not publishing, for example, the governing board meetings online.
No, indeed not. Yeah. It's the same for the BBI.
So for you, Martin, what on the level of transparency? I mean, it was not easy to get all the information, right?
No, clearly not, because those are in the case of the BBI in particular. I mean, that's at least the explanation I was given. Is that a lot of these projects are already almost at the commercial scale. And so there's a lot of information in there that would be relevant for competitors. Yes, but all of this is, you know, subsidized with public money. I mean, for me, and there's an interesting insight that we got also in the course of this research, is that So the most important document, I think, for each project that that gets funded by these partnerships is the consortium agreement. You know, because you have at the beginning. So let me just explain how it works. Industry defines the 7-year-long strategic research agenda, the general direction of research. Then they also draft every annual work plan. That is, what are the specific topics where the structure, the partnership, should issue call for proposals, should propose funding, bidded in a competitive way. And then the same companies that belong to these lobby groups apply to in consortia to these calls of proposals on topics that they have themselves defined, which puts them, of course, in a very interesting position to be selected, because, you know, they have high chances to actually be quite knowledgeable and expert about these topics. One thing that is important to see very clearly is that the major multinational companies don't get the public funding. They get something better. So they are part of the consortium. In this consortium, you have the multinational company usually, and then universities, public universities, SMEs as well. And plus one or two consultancies, usually, you know, to help run, that have experience in running EU projects, because you have a lot of technical reporting that requires specific skills. And then there's an agreement to organize the work between all these people before, you know, or during, but ideally before, actually, that's the recommendation actually from the partnerships themselves, to decide, you know, how in particular, who's going to own the final product. How is the intellectual property going to be organized? And in the IMI report in particular, there's some very clear evidence that there are issues there, Marine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To finish on the transparency, perhaps, this particular document, the consortium agreement, is nowhere to be seen. Mm-hmm. And even the Commission, if I understand well, doesn't have access to it.
Why is it important, especially for the case of DIMI and medicines? These consortium agreements, grant agreements, basically they contain information about the ownership of the results. Mm. So we know that in terms of access affordability, this is a very key issue. Whoever owns the results has the monopoly and can decide on the price of the medicines or other medical tools that could be produced as a result of the research projects.
Yeah, and to go on, because this is really key. So you have this pattern in general that the big multinationals, they define the work, then the public purse, the public sector finances, gives money to public universities and SMEs to do the work, like to do the research work. The multinational companies contribute, as they say, in kind. So they bring their own researchers and laboratories, for example, even though they oppose disclosing the documents that would enable auditors in particular and us to measure whether what they declare as in-kind contribution, you know, is real. I mean, that's a bigger discussion, because you have two different kinds of in-kind contribution. The auditable contribution and the non-auditable contribution. On the non-auditable contribution, industry basically declares what it wants, and the European Court of Auditors said that they have no way to measure whether these are real. Like, they can't have access to this information, and that's across all the joint undertakings. So these big PPPs. I mean, we've studied two. Originally, we wanted to study three. And after a week, we realized, like, no, only two is going to be a nightmare. Let's survive this. So we discarded the third one. The in total, these seven joint undertakings, like, use 7 billion euros of public money. So that's a lot of money. And across all these joint undertakings, there was the same problem. The Commission could not access basically most of the documents related to the projects. And so this is something that we found actually by doing access to document requests. I think it's there was finally, it's a letter from the legal services from the commission to all the executive directors from the joint undertakings. I think it is dated 2018, if I'm not mistaken, that informs them because they've been negotiating. Basically, the commission has had to negotiate access to the documents related to the project it was funding, which is interesting when you talk about so much money.
So this, as you describe it, doesn't really sound like a partnership to me, because that's what in what's in the name, a public-private partnership. And apart from that, can you explain a bit what are your general findings about these partnerships?
What we wanted to see when starting this research project was to assess whether IMI and BBI deliver the societal impact that they were set to deliver. And secondly, to see whether their claims of enhancing competitiveness also stands up to scrutiny, because these were basically the two objectives of these two partnerships and for the partnerships in general. So for both cases, the evidence and the facts that we found showed that they are not meaningfully delivering for the society. They are not helping to address the societal challenges that they were set to address. And secondly, for the second objective, the evidence of enhancing competitiveness is also quite limited. And especially in the case of IMI, these were concerns that were already raised in the so-called impact assessment that are commissioned by the European Commission, independent assessments they do in order to understand whether the EU policies, in this case, these partnerships, are delivering for the objectives they were set up to deliver. So this was one main finding, which answers to the main research question that was put before us, whether they are delivering for the objective they are delivering.
And the answer is no on both questions.
The answer is no, not meaningfully.
Not enough. Like, you cannot say that they don't do anything. Of course not. And some of the projects they are financing can be useful, of course. The problem is the proportion, really.
Yeah, especially in the case for IMI, what we did was basically the priorities that this partnership would fund were supposed to be picked up from WHO, World Health Organization, essential medicines list, which was again commissioned by the European Commission just to understand where is it that we need to invest in terms of medical R&D. And the WHO had come up with 25 disease areas. So what we did in the frames of this research to compare the disease areas in the list with the disease areas that are funded by the IMI. So what we found was that there is huge imbalance between topics that the IMI funded that are commercially interesting for the industry and topics that are so-called market failures, where we really need public investments, because otherwise private sector wouldn't invest because it is not commercially interesting for them. Just to give one example, there are 20 areas related to poverty-related and neglected diseases. 19 of these areas didn't get any meaningful IMI, didn't get any funding, basically.
There is in the report this example of fluocytosine, where there was quite some investment from the IMI into the research. Can you explain what this case is about?
Yeah, we looked into this case especially to understand whether IMI delivers for another objective that again was stated as its goal, which is, first of all, to help develop innovative medicines and make them accessible for patients. So we wanted to see whether there are examples of making them accessible. And we looked into this project because it was especially interesting in terms of the objective it had, which was to make one HIV drug that is called fluocytosine, more affordable in African countries than in countries where there is need of this drug.
Sounds like a useful project.
Yeah, exactly. And the way they would do it was through cutting the cost of the manufacturing of this medicine. So to summarize, they basically what we see as a result of this project, they managed to come up with more efficient manufacturing process. But then when we tried to understand whether this was actually applied to produce fluocytosine to make it affordable, as they were supposed to do, we didn't really find any evidence of this new manufacturing process being applied for the production of this drug. There was even requests to Sanofi, which is one of the main partners engaged in this project, to see whether they have applied the findings on this new manufacturing process, or did they do any technology transfer for another institute to research center or manufacturer to apply this. We didn't really get any reply.
So if I may summarize, the research was done by a UK research center in Durham.
University.
And after that, basically the French pharma company Sanofi took over the knowledge and used it for its own purposes, but didn't really use it for producing fluocytosine, a cheaper drug. Or
that is still an assumption. That is a question that we raise. What we know is that the university developed the new process very successfully. They got an industry prize for it. You know, in the UK, because it was recognized as a breakthrough, really, from an engineering perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Then a French SME got involved to scale this process up so that it could be applied to industrial processes, you know, from the lab to the factory, because you have, and that worked as well. Mm-hmm. This we know. That ended up in 2017, I think. And since then, we know that Sanofi has obtained, because Sanofi was a partner in the project, but we know that Sanofi has obtained some of the intellectual property on this, but neither Sanofi replied to the repeated questions we asked them. We called them, wrote to them. I got someone on the phone repeatedly telling me, yeah, we'll get back to you. Never heard anything. We got a bit more information from Durham University, who said that they were basically working on it, that they were hoping that the process that they had invented could be used for that, in particular.
Or making cheaper HIV medicine.
Yeah, because what's really irritating in this case is that, more than irritating really, is that this is an old medicine. It's been around for 60 years, and you have dozens of thousands of people in Africa who die every year because they don't have access to it, whereas if they had access to it, it would save them. You know, those are avoidable deaths. So the main manufacturer of fluocytosine in the world today is a generics company called Mylan. And public health NGOs like Médecins Sans Frontières, for example, have been pushing them very hard to bring fluocytosine to Africa, because they're not selling it there. It's not registered. Profitable. And so Mylan accepted to register the drug in South Africa. So that means that it's going to be able to sell it there. And to do so, they, according to the information that we got, they moved the plant to India so that they would be able to cut the production costs a bit. But when we asked Durham University whether Mylan got in touch with them to benefit from the new process, nope. So, and finally, why is Sanofi interested in that then? Well, two other drugs they're making and selling in much more profitable markets in Europe can be produced using this new process. So the question is, is Sanofi using this new process that was subsidized by taxpayers' money only to cut production costs, or is it actually also helping you know, people who mostly need this kind of technology. Because the name, I mean, the justification for the public funding was that. And interestingly, and just to cut a long story short, but the IMI got challenged actually on the basis of this case study, I think, by The Guardian on reporting on our story. And they say, well, basically, we cannot guarantee, we have very little visibility on the long-term fate of our product. So basically, sorry, it's not us, it's Sanofi.
So to get to the bottom of this, if I get it right, it would require journalists or politicians to keep on asking questions on how this story really will end up.
And to get Sanofi to answer the fucking question. Are you going to produce fluocytosine with this new process and selling to the people who need it the most at an affordable price?
Or what we've been advocating for several years already, when the Commission gives funding, to attach some conditionalities about also how they are going to use it, when. In terms of also agreements they are making with other producers or other companies, in terms of ownership, because these are all issues that are important for the use, final use of the results of the projects, but also about the price and accessibility.
Right. There, in one of the many newspaper articles on your reports this week, an MEP, Petra de Sutter, said, well, we know that IMI basically is a sort of subsidy channel for Big Pharma. Quite a blunt statement.
Yeah. Yes, but it's not enough.
But the issue is, again, the evidence shows that our investigation shows other reports, investigations that have been done previously or conflict of interest issues, cases, they show that there are major issues with this partnership in terms of, again, like agenda setting, where the money goes, governance, etc. So the reality shows that it's a subsidy, but why do we have to call it a partnership? Why to present it in a way that is misleading?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to say. Just don't call it a partnership. It just ends up to be a subsidy for the pharmaceutical industry with the way the money is managed and the money is used and controlled in the end.
Yeah, I agree with that. But at the same time, this is better than a subsidy because they get to have public universities and SMEs funded by the public sector to do their work. So subsidizing a company can be a political decision. I don't mind that. But don't use scarce and precious public research money for this. We need this money for other better uses than that.
And also, I think it was also in the case of BBI, IMI, a couple of years ago, they had admitted themselves that pharmaceutical industry, that this can help them fund things that they would be funding anyway. So it will be good for them to save the cash, plus come closer to the regulators, which is another dangerous outcome of this partnership.
If I get it right, IMI financed projects that are basically lobbying exercises.
Pre-lobbying, exactly. Developing regulatory proposals that are going to be used by industry lobbyists afterwards to lobby regulators. And this is also one of the reasons why these so-called partnerships are better than subsidies.
Right.
Because they give industry lobbyists privileged access to commission officials and to regulators. And, one of the projects that was funded by the BBI, the biobased industry, the partnership that I spent a lot of time researching, is about exactly that. Is about developing. It's three universities doing it, and you have basically multinationals in the board, you know, supervising, checking what they do. But the research is done by universities, public researchers.
Mm.
And what these researchers are doing is to develop regulatory proposals to basically help the bio-based industries get to market quicker.
I want to go deeper. We will go deeper into the findings on the BBI specifically. So I sorry to cut you there, but I before we do that, I just wanted to touch upon two last aspects of the IMI report. It was reported in many European countries this week when the reports were published. Basically, most journalists focused on the so-called proposal on bio-preparedness, how to be prepared for pandemics or this kind of things, which is obviously quite timely or important in these corona times. So basically, if I understood it right, it's about a proposal from the European Commission from 2017, and then it was discussed by the IMI in 2018, and the pharma lobby FPA basically said no. Is that correct? And why is this important, according to you, Marine?
Because the research was not meant to be on pandemics and epidemics in general. It was just an example that we found in the governing board minutes that showed that they just rejected to work on the commission's proposal on biopreparedness because, like many other poverty-related neglected diseases, biopreparedness and epidemics, it's also not something that is profitable for the industry to work on. And the proposal was basically about speeding up the vaccines approval process in order to bring them quicker to the market.
Now, this was covered in many European countries and basically outraged FPA, let's say the pharma sector, but also the IMI and the European Commission got a lot of questions from media. Basically, they said, well, although the Commission confirmed what was published by you, the main message was, but we are doing a lot, and these are not times now to start discussing these old cows, let's say. Let's look at what we're doing now. There's 119 million euros available, and let's work together to attack this COVID-19 crisis. What would be your answer to their criticisms or their anger?
Again, as Mahtan mentioned before, it's not we're not saying that they don't fund projects that are good, that are beneficial for the society, that are good in terms of improving health. It's just about imbalance, because we speak about billions of euros. In the case of IMI, for two funding cycles, it's 2.6 billion of public money funding research. Public research funding. So is this really the best use of the scarce public funding when we see that it's quite imbalanced in terms of the results it gives for the industry that is over 1 trillion euros worth? And with the situations when we really, really need urgent investments for life-saving vaccines and medicines. Do we really want to spend our money, public money, for helping them to maximize their profits?
And also, if I may add, indeed, we need to get solutions as fast as we can against the COVID pandemic. But the question is, what are the tools we are using for that? And we hear from, finally, actually, I would say, from governments, from Emmanuel Macron, from Angela Merkel, that they want the possible vaccines or medical technologies funded through all this, you know, public money, to be affordable, to be accessible to the public, to be a public good. I think that's even the word that was used. The problem is that if you use IMI to do this, you're creating problems for yourselves. Because with the conditions that are typically applied within IMI projects, you're not going to get a public good at the end.
So, Martin, let's dive into the BBI, bio-based economy research. Can you tell us what were sort of general findings that you saw there, and explain maybe what the research is about in the first place?
Yes, because if I tell you it's about the industrial bioeconomy, I'm not sure you will understand what I'm talking about. But in fact, this is just a new word to describe something that already exists, which is all the things we're doing with life forms, agriculture, forestry, fisheries, all the biomass that we eat, that we build with, that we heat ourselves with, that we use as energy, as materials, as, you know, everything nature gives us basically is biomass in that sense. Even though, I mean, you have to see where the word comes from. Biomass originally was invented by environmental scientists to describe the total mass of all the living beings in one given area. But in their mind, this, of course, included all the interactions between these living beings, all the complex ecosystems. But now this has been kind of commodified, so to speak, by the industry to talk about a bulk raw material as an industrial feedstock, to use their terminology. And the idea is very simple, is to replace fossil fuels with plants, mainly, in industrial processes. To do with plants what we used to do with fossil fuels, for example, to do fuels, to do plastics, to do materials, to do chemicals, to do everything, you know, basically we used to do with it. So that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Because we need to get rid of fossil fuels, and there's no discussion. We need to get rid of using fossil fuels as fast as we can, and we're not doing it.
It sounds like a good idea indeed.
Yes, exactly. It sounds like a good idea. And this is why the problem, this is the problem, in fact, is that it's very good at convincing politicians and officials that it is a good idea. The problem is you have to look at the reality. The reality in Europe is that we are already extracting from nature almost the maximum biomass we can through agriculture, and through forestry. When you look at the numbers, you can see that the amount of biomass that we are extracting from nature in Europe has not increased in the 15 past years, more or less. There's a slight increase in agriculture, thanks to the generalization of maize, for example, which is an extremely productive plant. But you're talking about really a marginal improvement. On forestry, it's rather the opposite, actually. You see that the numbers are slightly decreasing. Crucially, the carbon sink role of EU forests is slightly decreasing. And that reflects the bad practices that are being used in the forestry industry today. I'm talking about the replacement of mixed forests or even natural forests. I mean, there's few natural forests, real natural forests left in Europe, but you have at least mixed forests by monoculture, by tree plantations, basically, that are biological deserts. Like, there's just as much biodiversity in a plantation of pine trees as in a maize field drenched with pesticides. We are in Belgium here. There's many of them in the Ardennes. Walk in a pine tree plantation in the Ardennes and pay attention. Are you hearing any bird? Mm. Well, you're not.
But on the climate aspect, you're contesting that apart from the availability of the amount of biomass in Europe, are you contesting that biomass as such can play a role in a sort of greener, more sustainable energy production, for example, or?
Again, it's a matter of proportions, and the proportions aren't there. It's almost not discussed, but it's not decided upon. It is absolutely impossible to substitute the amount of fossil fuels we're using with plants. We would need, like, I've done a small calculation in the report, but you would need 7 or 8 times more biomass to cover this. So it's impossible.
Meaning importations from outside of Europe.
Yes, meaning neocolonialism, really, because 86% of the biomass that is growing on Earth is between the two tropics. It's not in Europe. And that's a crucial bit of information, actually, is that all that... So to kind of loop the circle, you have to see the difficulty of the report and is that it is doing two things. It is looking at the biobased industry's joint undertaking, and it is looking at the EU's bioeconomy strategy, which the BBIJU, so this partnership, is trying to implement. You have to see those two things together, because what the partnership is doing is, in that sense, it is a bit different from the IMI. It is spending a lot of money in building factories, which is which has very little to do with research, really. It's more about creating new technological innovations, new ways of doing things that we're already doing. The reason I was talking about and so you have to take those two things together. You have to see that if you create new industrial processes using biomass, you're directly coming into competition with food production and with biodiversity, with nature, basically. It's an old debate, actually, because of the biofuels and the bioenergy precedent. If you remember what I told you at the very beginning of this conversation, we started this research in 2007 contesting the biofuels technology platforms that the Commission was funding to develop, you know, strategic research agendas. Right. So that was, you know, so this is an old story. And the problem is that the EU is not learning its lessons.
On biofuels, they did, in a way, because it's sort of recognized that it was a wrong idea to invest that much. But you are saying now with this report that by considering biomass as a zero carbon resource and by investing in biorefineries, as yes. you describe in the report,
yeah.
that basically the European Union risks to repeat the old mistakes and to basically create a sort of locked-in syndrome where we will go more and more in that direction, which you say is in yes. the report is absolutely not a good idea.
So you have to see that. I have to retract a little bit what I've just said, that the EU is not learning its lesson. Some part of the EU administrations are learning these lessons. The numbers I quoted are coming from the Joint Research Centre, which is the European Commission's own inside scientific research centre.
GRC.
It's a very important organisation that few people know. And they're doing really good work sometimes. The DG Environment, actually, is also, I think, pushing, and we've seen that in the latest biodiversity strategy that they published last week. They are very concerned visibly about the use of whole trees. For example, the biomass lobby was not happy about this last week. But so what you're talking about, I think also at this point, is an internal conflict within the European Commission between those who are paying attention to reality or to the reality of nature, in this case, DG Environment, and the DG Research and Innovation, which is, as the name goes, which is primarily interested in, you know, innovation and making new stuff. It is a difficult discussion.
Because but it was about, are we learning the lessons? And if I understand you well, and if I see the report that you made, you get the impression that on this specific issue, we're not really learning, and the BBI risks of steering the European Union again in a sort of...
So the problem is, who decides what? In this case, what's happening is that you have new technologies being invented and created, sometimes, but sometimes not, with the help of EU subsidies. For example, I'm describing in the report the work of one semi-large company from Finland called MedGen. And apparently, they would have invented quite a breakthrough technology by which they are able to extract valuable chemicals from lignin. Lignin is basically what burns in wood when you burn it. And before, this was always a problem for the biomass industry. They didn't know what else to do with lignin. Lignin is a very important compound. It's what gives rigidity to plants. So that's what enabling trees, you know, to grow basically
and above to stand
the
ground tall,
and to stand tall, exactly. Now, their motto is everything that can be done with oil can be done with wood. So from their perspective, they are seeing a very bright future where everything that was done with oil is going to be done with wood thanks to their technology. The sky is the limit, you know? They are very excited about the technology. Understandably, from an engineering perspective, what they've done is probably very impressive.
Where lies the problem here?
Well, the problem is that there is a limit and it's not the sky. It's the reality of European forests and nature, and we, especially now, we are in a climate crisis. We need this forest to stay where they are, to keep sucking carbon from the air and removing it. Yeah, basically to reduce the amount of green gases in the atmosphere. And it's certainly not the moment to start cutting trees to do more plastics or more fuels or more whatever. And that's the, and you know, and so the argument of the biomass lobby, and they were quoted in one of the articles, I think, in Germany, reacting to the report, is that, oh, but those are, you know, old claims. Indeed, it is an old discussion. And biomass is 90% better than fossil fuels. Dot. That sounds like, you know, as a very strong argument.
And we want to be part of the Green Deal of the European Commission. That's also
That actually was the reaction of the industry lobby group involved in the BBI, because this is, again, a partnership between an industry lobby group and the Commission, 50-50. That gives the lobby group a veto power, basically, on what gets decided in terms of the priorities. Their reaction was that, I'm going to quote, because it is quite beautiful in its bluntness. We reject the unfounded and erroneous claims made against the BBIJU by the Corporate Europe Observatory and Global Health Advocates. You get credited for it as well, the EU. The biobased industries are a crucial partner to the EU in realizing the Green Deal and green recovery. We're talking about the huge budget proposal published today, as we speak, by the European Commission. And they want to be part of it. They want their subsidies to keep flowing. They don't like that we are criticizing this. The problem is that, in my opinion, and not only my opinion, but according to the research I've done, it's according to many NGOs who've been campaigning for this for years, according to the GRC, apparently, according to many scientific articles that I'm quoting in my paper, this is really not the time to start cutting forests for industrial processes, whatever you want to do with it. Not only forests. One of the projects that I'm describing in the report is very close from here. It's in Antwerp. It's called Perference. And the
right, it's making bottles from plants, right?
Sort of, yes, bioplastics. That's the idea. The idea is that they're going to make a new plastic compound made from sugar instead of oil. And you're talking big numbers, big volumes. You have Coca-Cola, Heineken on the partners said to be interested. But if you look at the source, where is this sugar going to come from? Well, one of the sources seems to be beetroot. Where are these beetroots going to be grown? They're going to be grown on farmland. So that's introducing, in fact, more competition for already scarce farmland. I mean, I've been working on the agribusiness sector for the past decade, more or less. There's all kinds of problems with the statement, but it is a very serious issue. It is not a given that we are going to be able to feed all these people with the amount of land we have without turning the whole planet into a desert. Or by reverting, or the alternative would be reverting to sources of nutrition. I'm not going to say food in this case. That would be done by chemical processes, by biotechnology processes. So you would end up with basically sugars and fats and a bit of fiber thrown in the mix to basically support you. But I wouldn't call that food, really.
I'm afraid we have to wrap up. As we speak today, when this conversation is taking place, you just mentioned that the European Commission is presenting in the Parliament a new a budget proposal for the next budget period of MFF. And one not very contested aspect of that total budget will be the money that the European Union will be spending on research under Horizon Europe. Figures range between 75 and 100 billion euros. It's really a lot of money. Trying to keep it short, but
industry is asking more. It's just like the Parliament, mind you. They're asking for 120 billion euros.
Right, rien ne va plus. Now, having done all this work and all this research on these two reports that we published, what would be your hope coming out of it? What do you expect from politics, or what do you expect from the academic world? Maybe Marine, could you start?
What I would say is that no one questions the importance of investing in research, especially given the need we have in our case for biomedical R&D with many medicines, vaccines, tools. But it's not just a matter of investing money, it's how you invest it and what are the results of these investments.
And who benefits?
Who benefits from it? From going back to the reports, we think there's enough evidence that shows that IMI is not well equipped to deliver for the society and to meet its objectives that it was set to deliver, especially in its current structure and current form. So we don't want the European Commission to invest again in a similar partnership if we know it's not going to deliver for the society. Why? I mean, we have more urgent issues to tackle with this money. Mm. And again, it's not about doubting the European Commission's intentions that they want to use this money in a way that is beneficial for the public, for the citizens. It's about coming up with a project years ago, hoping to achieve certain objectives, but then in the end, the results show, the results of our research, the result of different assessments, independent assessments, that this there's not enough evidence of this bringing added value, especially for the public. So now it's the time to reconsider whether do we want to invest our money for this partnership, especially with the COVID-19 crisis and climate crisis we're facing today.
Right. So you basically expect the European Commission to look seriously into the governance structures of these PPPs and to try and repair certain...
First of all, the way they are set is wrong by default, because what we say is that it delivers for the commercial interest rather than for the public good. But this is normal, because if you let profit-driven industry to decide on the objectives, of course they are going to deliver on what they are set to deliver, which is maximizing their profits. So unless the Commission and the public sector takes the lead in the governance and decision-making processes of these partnerships, it's not going to primarily serve the public interest.
Martin, if you can dream a bit, and you could be deciding, what do you hope to get out of all this?
Well, I'm not, unlike DG Research and Innovation, I am not a public official tasked, or a politician tasked with deciding on this. So I think it's important also to be a bit humble and to know where you stand. What we've done is to document quite convincingly, I think, and very rigorously, that if you give As Marine was saying, if you give the agenda setting power, the power to decide what should be done to industry is going to use it for its own purposes. It's not very complicated to understand, and it's very understandable that they would do it. And I would say that on the back of this conclusion, the first thing to do for the European Commission is to stop giving agenda-setting powers for the use of public research money to industry. Industry should be listened to, you know, in the frame of consultations, in hearings, in public debates. That's not the point. But you don't want them to decide on the use of public research money. That's the bottom line. And so, because if you let this go, then you can indeed have all the transparency you want, but that's not gonna solve your problem, really. Voilà. Now, for the rest, I mean, the politics of innovation, you know, that's a broader issue. One of the reasons we called the series of reports in the name of innovation is because that is industry's framing. In the name of innovation, they get what they want. In the name of innovation, they get away with really a lot. And this is actually exactly how the pharmaceutical industry reacted And that is, I think, an expression of a belief that they themselves had. You know, it is their professional culture. Look at what everything we've done. And they've thrown like a really ridiculous list of numbers of, you know, new things they've done. This for them is impact. And we say, well, just doing new things isn't solving our problem. It might be solving some of your problems, but that's not the reason why the IMI, for example, was created for. You know, we need public money to serve the public interest, to solve our problems. And in the middle of a COVID pandemic, in the middle of a climate crisis, we have problems, very serious ones. And we need all the money that's been, you know, doused by DG Research and others to serve these, to address these problems. Now is not the moment to make very rich people richer. There are more urgent priorities. I'm sorry.
Thank you both so much for this conversation.